Good morning. My name is Supervisory Wildlife Inspector Naeem Aziz. I run the inspection program at the Valley Stream Office of Law Enforcement, and we're tasked with manning the airports of JFK and LaGuardia, the passenger terminal, the mail facility. It's the largest wildlife port in the nation. We deal a lot with our local museums and institutions with the importation and exportation of wildlife coming in and out of my port. I help the Met on a couple of big exhibitions that happened after Director's Orders 210, and it was a very big learning experience for me, as I imagine it was for the Met and all the freight forwarders and shippers that were part of it. It's a very dynamic process where you're learning more every single day and how to facilitate it better and what documents to request up front. So I sort of put together a presentation on what I have learned since last February and try to impart it upon the collection specialists and the registrars in the room. So when you're dealing with your local port, if it's not JFK, that you can have the best tools at hand to facilitate the movement of your items. So part of our job is wildlife conservation. I mean, I put this picture in the front of all of my presentations so that the audience understands what our mission is. Everything in this photograph was seized coming through JFK International Airport. These are all wildlife that was trafficked in, smuggled, you know, concealed through the mail, that were not up to code, endangered species, CITES protected species that weren't accompanied by permits, and they were seized, and we kept them in our lab so we can help train new inspectors. I mean, we go out and we do outreaches to local schools and institutions, and we bring them with us so they can actually see what ivory looks like, what red coral looks like, sperm whale versus walrus, and what else did I both talk about? I was really into what he was talking about because that's what I do on a daily basis. I have a loop in my bag also, so he's not out of the ordinary. So the mission statement of the Fish and Wildlife Service is working with others to conserve, protect, and enhance wildlife, plants, and their habitats for the continuing benefit of the American people. So we start off our mission statement with working with others. Our agency is extremely small, and there's no way we can do it by ourselves. The United States has tons of wildlife within our borders, but some of the most taxed species do not live in the United States, so we have to work with other countries, other NGOs, other enforcement agencies to make sure that all the wildlife around the planet stays intact and is being used at a sustainable level so that not only I can go to Africa and safari and see African lions and leopards and elephants, but that my children and my children's children, and that will always be there. If you like to fish, that you can go to your local pond or your local river and you can fish today and you can fish 100 years from now and 200 years from now. So it's not about saying, no, you can't do this. It's about saying that we want to make sure everything is sustainable so that people can keep enjoying wildlife, whatever you like to do with it, that it will be here for eons and forever, hopefully. So the Office of Law Enforcement is usually, it's two-pronged. One part is the inspection program, and the other part is a special agent program. So the inspection program is part that most everyone in the room deals with. We're uniformed officers. We're located at the ports of entry. We're tasked with regulating the multi-billion-dollar wildlife trade. It is so expansive, and everyone is a very niche group. We have the registrars and collection specialists here. I mean, I've given presentations to the pet trade industry, the fashion industry, people who use wildlife in food, people who use wildlife in, you know, various different face creams, lotions. These are all uses for wildlife, and it's very expansive and it's very expensive, and a lot of people livelihood is dependent on using wildlife. So we want to make sure that everything is compliant and done at a sustainable level. Part of our job is interdicting and investigating the illegal wildlife trade. That is our main objective. We like to do that more than anything else in the world. When it comes to the legal trade, we just want to facilitate it, get it out of our faces off of our desk, get it into your museums so we can get out there and we can start dealing with people who are actually poaching animals, people who are actually commercializing illegal wildlife that is unsustainable. So that's why I come and do the talk, so we can all get on the same page, so we can move it through my port and on into your museums, and we can focus our time elsewhere. We're a very limited agency. We have very limited staffing. The more time we can focus on the illegal trade, the better we're going to be at our job. We review and inspect wildlife shipments, anything from the actual wildlife to the paperwork, the documents, the permits, letters of attestation, provenance, anything you guys provide for us, we're reviewing it, and we're crunching it down, we're looking it up, we're making sure it makes sense, we're calling you for additional information and feedback. That's what an inspector's job is. It's not just a physical inspection, which a lot of times we don't do physical inspections. The port of JFK has 35,000 declared wildlife shipments that come in. We get about 100 declared shipments a day, and I have about 9 wildlife inspectors. So there's no way for us to do 100% physical inspections. We use risk management systems like everyone else. What is the most bang for our buck? What items need to be physically inspected? What items can be cleared based on paperwork? So all this is built into the wildlife inspection program to make sure we can meet the need of the trade community and also not hang things up for an infinite amount of time sitting on warehouse floors. We're also tasked with enforcing, so all of the U.S. laws and regulations that a lot of the panel members have gone over, but also in other foreign laws, right? There's international treaties like CITES that the Fish and Wildlife Service is charged with enforcing. You know, Hong Kong has their own particular law. Ghana has particular wildlife laws. Tanzania, South Africa, every country has their own wildlife laws, and we're charged with enforcing that also. So via like the Lacey Act, if you are exporting something illegally from Colombia, there's no way you can legally import it into the United States. So you have to make sure you are doing things legally in the lending country to make sure that it can gain admissibility into the United States. But this is a lot of information for us to retain. I mean, there's 180 parties to countries, to CITES. There's so many countries around the nation, around the world, and we have to also be able to translate, digest, and retain each country's wildlife laws to make sure we're not inadvertently facilitating poaching or trafficking from another country. And then on top of that, when we actually do a physical inspection, I mean, we have to be able to identify millions of pieces of wildlife. Like, the easiest thing is looking at that. That's a snowy owl. I know that. It's a snowy owl. It's the whole bird. Sometimes you get the beak. Sometimes you get the feathers. Sometimes you get the wing feathers. Sometimes it's the tail feathers. Sometimes it's the feet. These are all things that the wildlife inspectors are trained to identify and be able to make a definitive identification based on the parts and products. Sometimes it's easy. Sometimes we send it to some of you guys in the audience who are also experts in identification. Sometimes we send it to our local forensics lab out in National Oregon to be able to make a definitive identification. But most wildlife inspectors are able to narrow it down at least to a family, or at least to figure out whether or not it is afforded a particular type of protection. So most people think, when wildlife, they think of CITES, Endangered Species Act. Wildlife is any wild animal, whether alive or dead, whether or not bred in captivity, including any parts, products, eggs, offspring thereof. It's very broad. We don't just care about CITES wildlife. We don't just care about endangered species. Anything that's considered wildlife has to be declared to the Fish and Wildlife Service, and most of that is just for data purposes. We need to know how much sea urchin roe is coming into the United States to make sure that the sea urchin roe trade is sustainable and that they're not over-harvesting them in Canada, because otherwise maybe we want to propose it to be listed on CITES. So that's why we take declarations for non-protected species. That's why we, you know, kick them back and make sure that you're declaring 2 ibex instead of 1 ibex. Even though they're non-protected species, we have to know how much is coming in and how much is coming out so we can make sure that it's all sustainable. There are particular things that are exempt. Most of these are domesticated species, so domesticated cow, domesticated chicken, domesticated turkey, these are things that are very commonplace out there in the trade and really don't have a conservation impact, so we're not collecting information on that. But that's particular to the domesticated species. If you have a wild cow, like a wild cow from India, some of those are endangered. Some of the wild cows from Africa, the bovidae, are going to be protected also, and we're going to require a declaration on. But if you're dealing with a domesticated goat that come from a goat farm and it's a leather jacket or maybe it's a wrapping around of an instrument, that's not something that we're going to require a declaration. It's not something you're going to be required to disclose to the Fish and Wildlife Service. But what I would tell you, if you're dealing with your foreign counterparts, is have them put all that information on there so that Susie or that masterpiece can make that particular determination of what to file and what to not file. But just because something, they have an idea that maybe it is domesticated and it doesn't have to be declared, you don't want them to leave it out because it's better to have more information than less information. So in New York, at JFK, I mean, fashion industry is big. This is what I spend probably 40% of my time on, is just like the Hermes, the Birkin bags, the Chloe, and all of them are out there, and they're all importing tons and tons of wildlife. So when you're out at the stores and you see an alligator handbag or a python shoe, realize that has come through the Fish and Wildlife Service, that someone has looked on at those documents, someone has done a physical inspection and determined a particular species ID. It's not something just flows through. So when you realize what our volume is, all of these things have to be declared. It's something as small as mother of pearl buttons on a shirt that has to come through the Fish and Wildlife Service. You guys are conservators and, you know, registrars, and you see how integral wildlife was to, you know, the human race, you know, thousands of years ago. It is still just as important and just as integrated into daily life nowadays. And all of this wildlife, from thousands of years ago to the stuff that's being made in China or Italy now, comes through the Fish and Wildlife Service, is declared and is part of our daily workload. Jewelry, when you're dealing with items of jewelry, maybe they're old, but realize that there's tons of wildlife in there also. I mean, anything from alligator watch bands, queen conch pearls, red coral, blue coral, these are all things that are wildlife and have to be declared to the Fish and Wildlife Service, regardless of it being protected or non-protected under CITES or the Endangered Species Act. All wildlife requires a declaration. Art acquisitions. I put these two pieces up particularly. Most of the time people want to talk about ivory and the new ivory laws, and these are antiques. And there's definitely a whole subsection of that. But tons of modern art uses wildlife products. That's a Damien Hirst painting that is chock full of butterflies. There's about 300 species of butterflies that are on this painting. And for some reason, they just like to import it and export it all the time. It's a declaration of about 35 pages of species that comes in and all the time, and the inspector has to go through and find the four-letter code for each particular species. And it's some, like, every 9 months, this painting comes in and out of JFK. So I hope someone eventually buys it and puts it up in their living room, and we can stop seeing the paperwork. This is also, I think, another Damien Hirst painting of a great white shark, which is a protected CITES listed species. But there's tons of modern art that have wildlife in there. A lot of times it's butterflies or it's bird feathers. You may have a, you know, someone has a piece. I'm not really big on artists. I don't know many names. But you have a cardinal feather or a blue jay feather, you know, and it's just an accent to the painting. But these are things that are protected under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. And it's not legal to possess. You can't move it across state lines. You can't import it. You can't export it. So just be aware of what's on a lot of this modern art. Sometimes the more avant-garde the artist is, the stranger the wildlife they're using. So make sure that you're getting proper information from the artist or the gallery where you're, you know, acquiring the item from. What is the actual scientific name of the wildlife? Where is it coming from? What's the country of origin? What is the source? Was it wild or was it captive? Maybe the piece is coming from France, but the artist is from the Czech Republic and picked up those bird feathers in their backyard. Like, these are all the information that you have to provide to the service, because that's how we make our regulatory decisions based on country of origin, scientific name, and the source of the wildlife. And then this is probably why everyone got into the job, the live animals. I mean, they're great. We see tons of them at JFK, and then sometimes you have a shipment and it's sitting and you're wondering, why hasn't Fish and Wildlife cleared it yet? A lot of times we're doing these sort of inspections that do take preference. Live and perishable shipments are the most important thing for the Fish and Wildlife Service. If there's a shipment of art that's sitting on a warehouse floor, but there are green snakes sitting out there also, we're going to do the snakes before we do your particular shipment. Your shipment is crated, and hopefully it's in a controlled environment, but it could be 100 degrees outside, and these animals could die or perish on the warehouse floor if we're worrying about the wrong thing. So that's why sometimes things take longer. There are tons of animals that come into the JFK airport and around the nation. I mean, we deal with curators from the Bronx Zoo, the Prospect Park Zoo, the Staten Island Zoo. All these zoos are importing live wildlife, Adean bears, tigers, polar bears, snow leopards, things that are so protected and need to get to their facility as soon as possible, and we're going to do those inspections first. Your inspections are probably the next one on the list. When it comes to our priorities, it's live and perishable, and then we do the other high prolific inspections, the museums. I mean, we're going to do your inspection before we do an inspection for Marc Jacobs of some handbags. Like, we understand the priority, but I want you guys to understand our priorities also. So I keep saying all wildlife has to be declared, so you want to know, how do you declare the wildlife? So the Fish and Wildlife Service, through our regulations, require the importer or the importer agent to declare the wildlife to the Fish and Wildlife Service. You have to declare it at the port of activity. If you're bringing in wildlife through JFK, you have to declare at my office in Valley Stream. If you're bringing in wildlife through Houston, you declare in Houston. You can't submit a declaration to me for a shipment that is coming in Los Angeles. So realize it's at the port of activity. We have an electronic declaration system where you can submit an electronic declaration and upload documents to us. If you guys are not on that or your broker doesn't do that, we still take the manual forms. You can get the PDF off the internet and fill it out and submit it to us. We just need a declaration, and the declarations have to be complete. It behooves you guys to supply the inspector with all the information that you can think of us asking about your shipment. So the base information is a complete and accurate declaration. We need the bill of lading. We need to know when your shipment came in, like what airline it came in on, what are the dimensions, what are the weight, who is it coming from, who is it going to. Detailed invoices that reflect all of the wildlife in the shipment. If you can provide color photographs for all of the pieces, that's also very, very helpful for us. And then dimensions, like we need to know if this is a huge shipment and I need to send three inspectors out to do it, or if it's something that's a little box that came in off of FedEx and we can pop it open. And all the required permits need to be submitted up front, right? If you don't have your CITES document yet, or it's, you know, you haven't got it from the airline, don't submit a packet to us because we're not going to be able to clear your shipment. We like to look at documents once. We don't like to look at them over and over and over again. And you keep supplying us, you know, new information, because that shipment sits on our desk and more shipments come in, right? And then we're dealing with other stuff. We like to do it while the information's still fresh in our head. The required fees, not very expensive, but they are required for clearance. Please remember, all wildlife is required to be declared. If we are looking at your declaration and you have just listed your CITES species, maybe you just have Loxodonta africana, the African elephant, and we're going through your invoices and it says something about cow bone, or it says something about antelope horn, and it's not on your declaration, your shipment's not going to be able to be cleared. We can't amend your declaration. We can't say, okay, you know, the MFA forgot to throw the antler on there. I'm going to assume that they're talking about Cervus elaphus and elk and throw it on there. That's something that I'm going to have to talk to Susie or Masterpiece about. And then they're going to go back to you, and then you're going to go back to your lending institution, and you're going to ask them, hey, what type of horn is this? And then they're going to relay it. And most of these places are far away, and you have a time difference. And, you know, we're not open on the weekends, so it's better to get all the information up front. So when I look at a declaration package, I can make a decision right then and there whether or not I'm going to physically inspect it. And if we are, we can get the inspection going the same day or the next day. But if we're going back and forth for information, you're going to drag your inspection at the border to days, sometimes weeks. And I know you guys don't want, and that's not something that we want either. This is what a declaration looks like. Hopefully all of you guys have seen it before. You should keep them as your records. Your freight forwarder or your customs broker should be giving them to you to show that the shipment has been cleared through the Fish and Wildlife Service and has been legal. A lot of times, a lot of countries are going to want the clear declaration in their document packet, like Japan. When it gets to Japan, if there's wildlife in there, Japan's also going to require a copy of the clear declaration. The top part is usually just the logistics, the date of import, the date of export, where it's going, where it's coming from. The bottom is the meat of the declaration. We're going to need a scientific name. You have to declare your shipments to species, right? If you have a tortoise shell, like Chelonidae, is not going to cut it on a declaration. You have to know if it's hawksbill sea turtle, or you have to know if it's green sea turtle, or loggerhead sea turtle. You have to be able to declare it to species. We're also going to need what it is. There's a bunch of description codes, but we're going to need the correct and appropriate description code. If you're saying it's, you know, a tortoise shell and you have Chelonis mitis and then you have a code for pearls, that's not going to make sense to us. That's going to hold up your shipment. Make sure that your broker or your freight forwarder has an accurate description of what the item that's coming in or leaving so they can declare it appropriately to us. The country of origin is the country of origin of the wildlife. So if you're telling me that it is a African elephant, ivory piece, and you have the country of origin as Italy, maybe it's an Italian piece of artwork, but there aren't any African elephants in Italy, so that's going to be an incorrect declaration, and we're going to have to bounce it back to your customs broker and the freight forwarder and ask for more information. So just keep this stuff in mind, that if you want to facilitate your shipment, give your broker or your freight forwarder accurate and like thorough information the first time around, because when we get it, we give the first declaration tons of time. But when you start to send additional information and it's 2 weeks later, like, that inspector has moved on to other things and they have to go back and get smart on your shipment so they can either give you clearance or not, and realize that it's best to get it the very, very first time around. And then if everything is good, we stamp the bottom of your declaration, cleared, right, either electronic cleared stamp or a red rubber cleared stamp. Keep that for your record. So if you want to send it back out, you can provide the DMA, the Department of Management Authority, with your CITES document that you used to import it. They're also going to request a cleared copy of your declaration that was used to import it to show that your shipment is legal and is able to be sent back out. So this document should be part of your record maintenance. These are our fees. Just $93 for anything and protected. If you're not operating commercially, then you're not going to be assessed a designated port inspection fee, but the $93 fee is, you know, standard. And then if you want anything reviewed on overtime, so this is going to be before, outside of our business hours, so early in the morning, late at night, Saturdays, Sundays, and on federal holidays were not open, those will all be overtime inspections. Realize that the Fish and Wildlife Service, the inspectors, they're a collective bargaining unit. So we're not always able to facilitate your inspections. If you want something on a Sunday and there's no one available to work on Sunday, we may not be able to say, hey, you have to go do this shipment. Maybe all the inspectors have already clocked too many hours for the week, or we can't force someone to come in on a federal holiday based on their bargaining unit. So keep these things in mind. Like, I would facilitate everything if I can, but realize there's also constraints to what we're allowed to have the inspectors do. There's a certain amount of hours that they're capped at working per week, per year, per pay period. So my guys in JFK, I mean, we are rocking and rolling and we do tons of overtime, but it gets to the point where sometimes some of the inspectors are not able to do it anymore. Or they're exhausted and they like to spend time with their families also during Christmas or Thanksgiving. Giving or it's Veterans Day recently. I think the Met had their Congo shipment that came in over Labor Day, and you know, it was really difficult to get an inspector to go out there and to do the documents and do the inspection. I ended up going out to do the inspection for the Met and for Masterpiece, but realized we're not U.S. Customs and Border Protection. We don't have an infinite staff of thousands of inspectors and officers that each port you're dealing with. My port in JFK is the largest, and we have 9. Some of these places are single-man duty stations, and there's only one inspector there, and they can't work around the clock. I think Susie had a picture of the customs ports. This is the Fish and Wildlife designated ports. So if you want to import and export wildlife, you have to funnel it through one of these ports. That's what the Endangered Species Act set up, is particular ports around the nation where we're going to staff wildlife inspectors so we can make sure that we are collecting proper documents and that we can enforce the Endangered Species Act. If you can bring it in through every customs port, we would need to have a service as big as Customs and Border Protection to be able to facilitate every single inspection and shipment that comes in. So realize that you can't use every single port. There are 18 of them, and these are staffed with Fish and Wildlife Service officers, and you can bring your wildlife in through there. Realize there's no designated ports on the northern and southern border. So if you want to have something trucked to Canada or trucked in from Canada, you're going to have to apply for a different permit. It's going to call a designated port exception permit, and you're going to request to the Fish and Wildlife Service, I'd like to use the Port of Buffalo or Amherst to bring down my items from Canada because of X, Y, and Z. You have to provide us with a reason for us to give you an exemption. So either it's, you know, a hardship exemption, maybe it costs too much money to ship it from Montreal or from Toronto to JFK. Maybe it's a deterioration of loss. Maybe your item is so valuable that if it were to come from Toronto, you'd have to ship it to Miami, and then from Miami truck it back up, and that your piece could get broken during that time frame, and we can grant you an exemption based on that. And then for scientific institutions, we can also grant you an exemption for scientific purposes. But if you don't have a designated port exception permit, you have to funnel all your activity through the 18 designated ports. What's a permit? A lot of people talk about CITES documents or import-export license. A permit is pretty much any document that's given to you that demonstrates that you were granted for and have been given an exemption, right? So a CITES document is an exemption from the CITES prohibition. The CITES prohibition says you can't deal with anything that's CITES listed. If you're giving a CITES document, right, an import permit, traveling exposition permit, a pre-convention permit, you're being granted an exemption from the CITES prohibition. So you have an import-export license. So I learned recently about deaccessions. That's not something I was very familiar with. But if you are deaccessioning something, you're going to have to get an import-export license if you want to send or sell the piece internationally. That's going to be an exemption from the prohibition that says you can't engage in wildlife trade. An Endangered Species Act import-export permit that's going to allow you to trade in an Endangered Species Act when everyone else is given the prohibition when you're not able to do it. So realize that if you do not have a permit, then you're not being granted an exemption, right? So that's why they're very important, that you have them, that they're validated, that they're for the particular species that you are trading in, because other than that, we have to do the default for the prohibition. And the service has permit biologists and legal examiners. In some of the offices of law enforcement, we issue particular permits, but most of them are located in Church Falls, Virginia now, where it's the Department of Management Authority, and they'll issue your particular permits. The service allows 6 months to issue a permit. So most of the time it doesn't take 6 months, but make sure that you build it into your schedule that if it does take 6 months, that you have the 6 months to spare. As more and more things become protected, they have to issue more and more permits, and the time frame is a little bit drawn out. But they do try to facilitate and expedite some of the high priority shipments. And a person must obtain a valid permit before conducting the activities. There's very few cases where we'll allow you to apply for a permit retrospectively. CITES is the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Fauna and Flora. It's an international agreement. There's 180 different countries that are party to CITES, and it was enacted in the 70s to make sure that the wildlife trade, which was at that time unsustainable, is managed and operated and controlled by every particular country. So if you want to export something out, there's a whole review process that happens in the exporting country, and there's another review process that happens in the importing country to make sure everything is sustainable. This CITES was put in place for institutions like yourself, for Marc Jacobs and Louis Vuitton, that likes to use wildlife products, and we're saying you can continue to do it as long as it's sustainable, and we put in process this whole treaty to make sure that it's being monitored and that the wildlife will continue to be around. So the CITES dependencies. If something is listed on CITES, it's going to be categorized in three different levels. Appendix 1 is for, it's not sustainable for commercial trade. And you're going to need two levels of review. Review in the exporting country, you're going to need an export permit, and you're also going to need an import permit from the importing country, right? This is for things that are Appendix 1. Appendix 2, you're just going to need an export or a re-export permit from the exporting country. And Appendix 3, you're going to need an export permit or a certificate of origin from the exporting country. This is all for contemporary species. If you're dealing in something that is old, you're going to be probably granted a pre-convention exemption, right? So anything prior to 1976, when CITES was enacted, you're going to be able to get a pre-convention certificate, and you're not going to have to worry about all these different types of permits. But if you are dealing with contemporary items, things that are after 1976, you have to make sure that you're getting all the proper documents. And then the CITES listing, you can find it at CITES.org. There's a checklist for CITES species. You put in the scientific name, and it gives you the protection level of the animal. If nothing comes up, then it's not protected under CITES. So not every wildlife is protected under CITES, but make sure you check, because if it is a CITES-protected species, it's going to be required to be accompanied by a CITES document. So this is an example of a pre-convention certificate, right? So the pre-convention is for specimens that were acquired before it was listed on CITES. So, for instance, what's a good example? Red coral. There's five species of red coral that were recently listed. They are were listed in 2008. So if you are dealing with red coral and it was recently taken out of the sea in 2006, you're going to need to have a CITES document. If you have red coral antiquity jewelry that's from, 200 years ago, you're going to be able to get a CITES pre-convention certificate for the piece of coral, and you're going to be able to move with it, and you're demonstrating to us that this does not impact the wild population because it was removed from the wild prior to it listing. But realize there's a couple of conditions. One thing is that on the CITES document, you need to have a circa date, right? So if the item was removed from the wild, you need to have that date, or if it was acquired, whatever date it was acquired before CITES applied to it, that date needs to be listed on the face of the permit. If you don't put it on the face of the permit, your CITES is not valid. Switzerland has a bad habit of leaving the circa date off of the permit, so make sure that you're looking at your documents properly and making sure that everything is provided. So a pre-convention certificate requires a circa date. A pre-convention certificate also allows for the permitteer, the applicant, you can apply for a CITES document to a higher taxonomic level. So on your CITES document, if you're trading in particularly like sperm whale teeth, and you don't know exactly what type of tooth it is, right? Maybe you don't know it's sperm whale, but you know it's one of the tooth whales, you can apply for a CITES document to the order of like cetacea for all of the particular whales and porpoises, and they'll give you a document for that. As long as it's a worked, manufactured article, you don't have to always get your CITES document to the species. It allows for a higher taxonomic level. Your declaration needs to still be made to species, right? And you have to provide us with documentation to show why you think it is particular sperm whale or why you think it's elephant ivory, African over Asian elephant. But your CITES document can be at the Elephantidae level, right? So it would cover all elephants, And then you can do the research in your institution and figure out what type of elephant it is. What I was telling Emily from the Met is that, the Fish and Wildlife Service where when it comes to non-commercial old shipments, we'll allow you to amend your declaration, right? That's not a difficult thing for us to do, is to have discretion and have you change your declaration. But if your CITES document says Loxodonta africana, right, and then through research or provenance, you figure out that it's a Lathus maximus, we can't change a CITES document. That's not something we can X out and write a new species on there. So if there's ambiguity in what you're importing, I would suggest personally getting a CITES document at a higher taxonomic level that covers all of it, right? And then you can figure out, and we can declare to species on the 3177. So what Susie was talking about is validation is extremely important. Just most of the CITES documents are being issued based on paperwork, right? So you submit paperwork to the management authority, or the lending institution submits paperwork to the management authority, maybe color photographs, maybe some other items, and they issue you a permit, right? I don't know how many times I have a permit for one particular species, and then I go and I do a physical inspection, and it's a completely different species, right? That's because a lot of the times the shipment is just based on paperwork. When you're leaving your country of export or re-export, you're required to give your CITES document to whatever the inspecting official is. They're either doing a physical inspection or they're reviewing your paperwork and making sure everything is in order. And at that time, they're going to validate your permit with a stamp, signature, and the actual quantity being exported. Without a complete validation, your CITES document is not valid and it's not going to be allowed into the United States. So you could do all the work up front, and then your freight forwarder or the person who's carrying it, hand carrying it to the United States, doesn't go to that customs official and it arrives at JFK or arrives at Dulles Airport and you don't have a validated permit, there's no way we can allow it into the United States. So realize that is a very critical and easy part for you guys to fulfill, is to just train anyone who's handling your CITES document to make sure that they're bringing it to the proper authority to get it validated upon export. Traveling exhibition. These are, you know, permits that are being widely used nowadays. It's for the international multiple cross-border movement of either pre-convention or bred in captivity. Pre-convention or bred in captivity wildlife. So where the traveling exposition resides, so if it's U.S. from the Met, they're going to apply to the Department of Management Authority in Virginia, and they're going to get the permit there. If the British Museum is lending an institution here, they're going to apply for the traveling exposition with the British Management Authority. These things are great. They're good for 3 years. You don't always have to get a subsequent re-export permit. It's good for 3 years. It covers the entire exhibition, and every time you cross a border, we take a copy of your CITES document and we validate it, right? So when you come into JFK, we do the inspection, we take a copy of the CITES document, we validate the original, and we give you back the original. When you leave out of LAX, maybe it travels around the U.S., you provide it to the inspectors in LAX, they take a copy and they validate it again for export. When you go to Japan, they validate it coming in, they validate it going out. So it works like a passport and it's good for 3 years. You can go to one country, bring it back here to the United States, and then you want to go out again the next year, you can use the same CITES document. They give you multiple pages for validation. You just have to make sure that the items return back to the home country before the permit expires. The certificate, but the caveat is these items can't be sold or transferred outside of the home country, right? So this is for the non-commercial movement of these items. But they're very helpful. I mean, orchestras use them, museums use them, anyone who can get one uses them, and they love them because it makes it that much easier. And then also, if it's the same items that moving over and over again, like, it's easy for us to do stuff based on paperwork. If I've seen these items two times before, it's coming back in for the third time, I have my stamp on there. I was the one who did the inspection. It's easy for us to facilitate these coming in and out if it's bound by the same CITES document. This is what they look like. I don't know if anyone's ever seen them. This is not a U.S. one. This is a U.K. CITES document, but it has the permittee. So it's going. This one was, I think, the British Museum. But there is no importer, right? The importer and the exporter are the same. So it's just the British Museum gets a traveling exhibition, and it goes all around the world. It has to still have the same information, like the scientific name, the source of the item, the appendices it's listed under. Everything is permitted on the document, and then here here's your continuation sheet. So when it goes in, it gets stamped. When it goes out, it gets stamped. When it goes back in, it gets stamped. And it gets stamped all the way around. I mean, there's 5 or 6 pages to this continuation sheet that just every time it moves. And it's very helpful. And if you are importing African elephant ivory or exporting African elephant ivory, they're required to be bound on one of these CITES documents, right? That way we know that this is not part of the illegal trade, that this is something that went out, it belongs to one of our institutions here, and that it's going through all these countries and it's returning back to the United States. And that's not going to be sold while it's outside the United States. You know, in China, even if someone in China offers them $1 million for the piece, that they're not going to sell it because it's bound by this particular CITES document. So everyone's talking about the director's orders 210. I guess that's what sparked a lot of the, you know, the concern amongst the museum community. Last February, the Fish and Wildlife Service, particularly Dan Ash, the director of the service, came out with director's orders 210. Realize that a lot of the stuff has always been on the books. We're just now strictly enforcing it, right? What it did do was restore the moratorium on the importation of African elephant ivory, right? It only applies to African elephant ivory, and it says that you're not allowed to import it. Most people, right? If you want, the exceptions is for law enforcement purposes, scientific purposes, musical instruments, traveling expositions that are on those passport-like documents, and then inheritances and household moves, right? Those are the exemptions that were granted. Most people didn't get the exemption, but your institution was granted that exemption. All we're requiring is that... all we're requiring is that, one, that the item is pre-convention, right? That it was removed from the wild prior to 1976. We require that it is bound by one of these passport-like documents. That means it's going in and coming back out, or going out and coming back in. We require that it hasn't been held in the course of commercial activity since February 2014 when we enacted the director's orders. And I think that's all that we require. Right? So, you know, it doesn't sound like that much, but just make sure that it doesn't apply to newly acquired items. This is for everything. Like the beginning, when the first director's orders came out, the beginning date was 1976, right? Anything that was acquired after 1976 was not allowed to be imported into the United States. The Fish and Wildlife Service reflected on that and realized that maybe that was a little stringent, and that now the new effective date is February 25th, 2014. Anything purchased prior to that, that's African elephant ivory, that is also pre-convention, can move and be lended to other institutions as long as it's on that passport-like document. Okay, so the second part of director's orders is strict enforcement of the Endangered Species Act. All these things in the Endangered Species Act have been there before. There's a lots of new rules that are coming out. I'm not going to talk about them. I'm probably not the person to talk about them, but this is how it is right now. We strictly enforce the Endangered Species Act. The Endangered Species Act prohibits the import and export of endangered or threatened species. It prohibits the take of endangered or threatened species. It prohibits the possession, sale, delivery, transport of any species that's illegally taken, right? So this is for illegally taken. So if you want to move something from Massachusetts to New York, right? According to the Fish and Wildlife Service, if the item was legally imported, legally acquired, legally possessed, you can move that non-commercially. That's not something that we're restricting. What we're going to restrict is any sort of interstate and foreign commerce of endangered species unless you qualify for an exemption. So do not feel, you know, worried to move your item from one museum in the U.S. to another museum in the U.S. if this is a non-commercial movement of legal items, right? That's not something that we are cracking down on. That's still allowed. Any person that's claiming an exemption to the regulations, you guys have the burden of proof of proving that the exemption or the permit is applicable and has been granted and is invalid at the time of the alleged violation, right? So when it comes down to the Endangered Species Act and the antique exemption, you guys have to prove that you guys qualify for the exemption. And that's what all the hullabaloo is about, is the documentation and the process of proving that you guys are you guys qualify for the antique exemption. Most people, I guess I was talking to Emily and she wasn't aware of the pre-act part of the Endangered Species Act. The pre-act part is similar to pre-convention. So if you have a endangered or threatened species that was held in a controlled environment, like at your institution, maybe it's not over 100 years old, maybe it's only 80 years old, but it has not also been held in the course of commercial activity, right? You guys purchased it sometime in 1960, 1940, and it's been at your institution in your collection and you want to lend it out, that's something that you're going to be able to do. You can qualify for the pre-act exemption, and we're going to let you lend it out as long as it's not moving in the course of commercial activity and as long as it has not been held in the course of commercial activity since 1973. You have to provide us with documentations for that. A lot of times it's like your catalog, is that what it's called, like your registered catalog, where
the accession files
when it was accessioned into your institution. Maybe you obtained it non-commercially from another institution, or for maybe someone passed away and they willed it to your institution. All those documents are going to come into play for you to be able to get this pre-act exemption. But people get it every single day as long as it's non-commercial and has been held in a controlled environment. So, letters of inheritance, museum records, archives, photographs, provenance, these are all things that we're looking for to make sure that you qualify for the pre-act exemption. The antique exemption, all right, so most people have this, everyone had this similar slide. First thing is first, it has to be over 100 years old, right? So that's the basis line for an antique. Over 100 years old. The item has to be composed in whole or in part of an endangered or threatened species. The article has not been modified with any endangered or threatened species since December 28, 1973. That's the enactment of the Endangered Species Act. So you have a piano and maybe some of the wires pop. You replace the wires, it doesn't mean your item is not an antique. If you have a piano and some of the keys break and you replace the keys, that makes your item not an antique anymore. So you can make other modifications. You just can't make modifications to the endangered or threatened wildlife that's on your item. And the article has passed through an ESA antique port, but the ESA antique exemption allows you not to have to have an ESA import permit, right? You meet all of these conditions, and therefore your stuff is an antique, and you can move it in and out. That's always been on the books. What it is a documentation to show that. In order for us to know the endangered or threatened species, you guys have to be able to tell us that, right? It's no longer going to be elephant today, where it can be Asian elephant or African elephant. We need to know which one it is. There are different protection levels for each one. The Asian elephant is endangered in Appendix 1. The African elephant is threatened in Appendix 1 in some places, right? It's in Appendix 2 in other places. These are all the protection levels for the animal, and we need to know what type of animal it is so we can give you the proper exemption that you guys are granted. The CBP antique ports, this is not a fish and wildlife thing. These are customs ports that have been set up by U.S. Customs and Border Protection. In 1982, they set up 13 antique ports where they have antique teams that are there that are reviewing the documents for anything that's being claimed an antique exemption. Some of these antique ports are not wildlife ports, particularly like Pennsylvania, Philadelphia. That's a customs antique port. You guys can import and export wildlife at that port that are antiques, and Fish and Wildlife Service is not there. Customs turns over the documents to the Fish and Wildlife Service. We do a review afterwards, but these are the ports that are set up by CBP. A lot of this stuff probably will be changing in the future with a couple of the new information systems that are coming down, but right now, if you have an antique, you have to move it into the United States at one of these 13 antique ports. They only came in existence in 1982. So if you had something that's been in the United States prior to 1982, you don't have to meet that part of the ASA exemption. We're not going to ask you, hey, when did this come into the United States and where did it come in? But if you have something that's entered in after 1982, we're going to ask you, where did it come in? And if it did not arrive in the United States as at an antique port, that's not something that we're going to be able to grant the antique exemption for. So some of the documentation requirements. What I'm looking for and what my guys are looking for is documentation to definitively prove the age and the species of the item. That's all we're looking for. Like Honorable said, most of the time these people are not the same person. It's going to be very difficult for them to scientifically identify the species and do the age. So sometimes there's two different appraisals. Sometimes one person is, you know, Superman and can do them both. But that's what we're looking for. The appraisal needs to be from a third party, right? It cannot be the importer, it cannot be the exporter, it cannot be the consignee. It has to be someone who doesn't have a vested interest in the actual importation or exportation of the item. The appraisal should also include the education or the background of the person making the appraisal. A lot of times I get an appraisal and I ask, you know, Deedle or Masterpiece, can I have the CV for the gentleman or the lady who actually made the appraisal to make sure that they have the education background to make that. Like sometimes when you look at the CV, you're like, that's really interesting. Like, how did you know all this stuff, right? Like, maybe you have multiple CVs, but that's part of the process is to vet the person who's also making the appraisal. They should include the scientific method, whether it's light using a light microscope, whether it's looking you know, through the natural eye. Maybe it's using UV light. Sometimes it's via photographs. Some people are identifying things via photographs. And that all information is relevant and should be included in the documentation. The description of how they're identifying the item should be fluid enough where a wildlife inspector in hand with the documentation and the item can go through the actual appraisal and come up with a similar determination. Like, okay, yeah, I see what they're saying there about the lacquer. I see what they're saying there about the coloration on this tape part of the tabletop. That's how we go through the documentation to make sure it makes sense. It should include a description and or a photograph of the item being appraised. Also the dimensions, you know, so we understand, like, you know, if he's making or she's making, you know, determinations and the item is extremely small and they're saying they looked at it via photograph, like, all those things don't make sense to us, and that's when we ask for additional information. But if you have a really detailed appraisal, that's something that, you know, can expedite your shipment. A lot of the brokers in JFK and freight forwarders, I mean, once they get the appraisal, they'll send it to an inspector to take a look at to see if this is something that they need additional information, or do you want me to add anything or subtract anything, or, you know, does this make sense? Does this guy has a qualified CV that you're, you know, have you seen this guy's appraisal before? Those are all the things that sometimes can happen beforehand to expedite the shipment. Not every port has the ability or the staff to, you know, entertain that, but at JFK, I mean, we deal with a lot of just high-profile institutions, and we like for when it to come in and come in successfully. You know, we get no comfort in rejecting shipments for some, you know, these institutions that we visit on the weekends. So another one I want to mention is the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. I talked a little bit about that earlier, but realized that this is stricter than the Endangered Species Act. It's stricter than CITES. There is no possession, interstate movement. There's no acquisition, sale, barter of migratory bird feathers. These are eagle feathers. These are cardinal, blue jays. These are waterfowl, you know, duck feathers. Those are all going to be protected under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, and modern art uses tons and tons of migratory bird feathers. The list of federally protected migratory birds can be found at 1013 in our Code of Federal Regulations, and they're broken down by common name first, and then there's another section that does the scientific name. But make sure that when you're getting your invoices from your lending institutions, that they're detailed and they're complete, so the brokers and the freight forwarders can go through all of this, the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, they can go through the Endangered Species Act, the CITES Convention, the Wild Bird Conservation Act, the Marine Mammal Protection Act, to make sure that your item is going to be able to be legally imported into the United States before it has already been imported into the United States. We like to front load a lot of this work. Inspections at the port. Like I said, we're not able to do physical inspections. I mean, if we do select one of your shipments for physical inspection, we definitely coordinate with the institution for you guys to have art handlers come down and present the item to us. Like, these inspections make us just as nervous as they make you guys. We want you guys to bring your team down, and we prefer just to walk around your item, right, and you guys maneuver it around so we can take a look at it. The last thing anyone wants to do is to break some piece of cultural heritage being lent from, Iran or South Africa or Timbuktu that comes in here, and we select it for physical inspection, and we demolish some Sudanese art. That's not what we're looking for. That's not what you're looking for. If you guys can provide us with staff to help us look at the inspection, that's the best. That's the best case scenario. We are only open during Monday through Friday during regular business hours. Those are our legal trade hours. There are inspectors who do overtime shipments on the weekends and after hours and early in the morning. Those are at the availability of an inspector being there and you guys requesting the inspection. Federal holidays, we're not working. We can facilitate an inspection, but just give us enough time. Emily said that you guys start the process 10 months in advance. If you know 10 months in advance or 6 months in advance that your shipment's coming in on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day, that's something you should let the Fish and Wildlife Service know about as soon as possible. Some people, if you really give us enough, forethought and you notice, some people I live in Queens. I live near the JFK Airport. It's not a big deal for, if I know that it's really important to you that you let me know that far in advance to come down, Christmas morning and do an inspection, That's what we are willing to lend to you guys as long as you're giving us proper notice. But if it's, a week in advance or 2 weeks in advance and you have something on, Veterans Day or Labor Day, I may be out of town or no one's going to be able to do the inspection. So build this into your process of getting your items together, getting the appraisals together, integrate the Fish and Wildlife Service in that conversation so when everything can run smoothly from the beginning to the very end. I put this up there because everyone says ivory. Why are we worrying about the museums? We're worrying about everyone, right? We're worrying about the sports hunters. We're worrying about the galleries. We're worrying about the museums. We're worrying about everything. Like the crisis with the African elephants is so dire that everybody has to be part of the conversation now. It can't just be the sports hunters. It can't just be the galleries. It can't just be the people in Tanzania or in South Africa or Botswana where the elephants live. It has to be China, the largest importer of ivory. It has to be the United States, the second largest importer of ivory. Everyone's part of the conversation now, and that's why there's stricter enforcement of the laws, and that's why when it comes to people who are a part of the legal trade, we want to help you out. We want to get it through. We want to make sure that your stuff is the legal stuff. And once we determine that, we don't even want to take a second look. Refused shipments. Everyone says, Susie called it CITES jail. What happens when a shipment is refused? I mean, we have a couple of options. One thing is re-export, which happens most of the time. Your shipment comes in, the permit's not validated, we're going to send it back, you get a new CITES document, you bring it back in. That's what's going to happen 99% of the time. If you're bringing in something that is legal, right, that could have been imported in the United States, that's not an endangered or threatened threatened species that is really, really old, and maybe it's a technical or a paperwork error, we're going to allow you to re-export and bring it back. If you're bringing in something that's maybe a contemporary endangered or threatened species, these are not things that allow for re-export. These are things that are, this Fish and Wildlife Service is going to seize. We're going to effect a seizure on that, and there's a whole process through the Office of the Solicitor of the Department of the Interior where you can petition to get your items back. You can let us know all the details that you guys think are relevant to get the item back, and then the solicitor makes that decision. That's not a decision made by the Office of Law Enforcement or the seizing officer. It's an uninterested third party that knows the laws and regulations and takes into consideration mitigating circumstances. And then the last thing is, if we do nothing, if it's not an endangered or threatened species, we may just refuse clearance on it and Customs will auction it off. That doesn't happen very often because most of the time there's an endangered or threatened species on the item, and Customs is not allowed. We're not going to allow Customs to send some endangered or threatened species back into the commercial trade. So those are the things we're normally going to re-export, or we're going to effect a seizure and allow you guys to petition or do a court claim, and then under those circumstances we can either re-export them back or give them back to the institution. But this is sort of what our options are when it comes to refusing clearance on a shipment. Sometimes we can't clear shipments if there's no permit. We can't clear shipments if the permit's not valid. Like, there's nothing that allows us to do that. If it was, we probably would. Like, we don't want to hold things up, but if there's no framework for us to grant you guys clearance and legality for a shipment, then we're not going to be able to do that. So I just want to once again reinforce that these are the stricter national measures, right? This is what the United States has. We have the Lacey Act, the MBTA, Bald and Golden Eagle Act, the Endangered Species Act, African Elephant Conservation Act, Wild Bird Conservation Act, Marine Mammal Protection Act, and the Rhino Tiger Act, right? If this is what the United States has, what does Belgium have? What does Italy have? What does Japan have? What does Australia have? Every country has their own stricter national measures. CITES is not the end-all, be-all to everything. And then layer on top of that, in the United States, every single state has their own wildlife conservation law. So it's a very sticky matrix that you guys have to navigate. But what the best thing I would say is to reach out and call that agency, get the information, but be armed with all the information they're going to require. If you call my office and you say, oh, I want to export this particular type of butterfly, right, the first thing we're going to ask you is the genus and species, where did you get it from, and what's the point of the exportation, right? Those informations, we're not going to be able to make a regulatory decision until we acquire that. The state of New York is not going to be able to make a regulatory decision until you give them all the facts of how you acquired the ivory. Italy's not going to allow it in until you give them all the facts of what the importation is like. So realize that there's a lot of people with their hands in the mix when it comes to wildlife, the movement of wildlife, and you just have to make sure you satiate everyone and that you make sure you layer on top of, you meet every single act. The Endangered Species Act, the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, just CITES doesn't cover everything. Whatever, these are contacts if you deal with the Port of New York. Contacts for the Port of Elizabeth, which is a pretty big seaport, but you guys don't normally use seaports. But this is the contacts for the Division of Management Authority. They're the ones who you apply to your CITES document. They're the ones who have the legal examiners who are issuing your traveling exhibitions, your pre-convention certificates. And then you have the Migratory Bird Treaty Office, Migratory Bird Office. So if you're dealing with any sort of migratory birds, you have to go in region. So the Fish and Wildlife Service is broken up into 9 different regions. So Region 5, Maine to West Virginia. If your institution resides in Region 5, between Maine and West Virginia, you apply to this Migratory Bird Treaty Office. If you're located in California or Oregon and Washington State, you apply in Region 1 or Region 8 now. So realize that you can't just send it anywhere. They're broken up into regions, and you have to apply for certain permits within region. These are great websites. I mean, I have them all bookmarked. I have a Fish and Wildlife website that Susie helped you guys navigate. We have the OLE website, the CITES website, the public bulletins. When things happen, they just normally happen. We put it out there to the public, notice to the import-export community, public bulletins, this species is now listed on CITES, this is happening, that's happening, so you guys can stay in the know. And then we have our electronic code of federal regulations, which is updated every time there's something new happening. No, that's about it. I just want to show you one other photo. So I know that they showed the photo of all those tchotchkes that were on the side of the road. The Fish and Wildlife Service conducted an ivory crush in New York City in June of this year, where we crushed over one ton of ivory that was confiscated from multiple investigations. The majority of the ivory, over a ton of it, came from one particular investigation that happened out of the Port of New York, where there was an art dealer and gallery owner located in Philadelphia that was importing ivory from Western Africa and smuggling it in through the Port of JFK and Elizabeth. But he actually took the ivory and stained it and was trying to claim antique exemptions for the ones that he did declare, and a lot of the stuff was smuggled. So realize that, as we said before, that some of these items of antiques actually fuel some of the wildlife trade. It's really difficult to get the hands on the items that you have. They cost millions of dollars, but some of these things that are replicas and some of them are very poor replicas, are on the market and people are buying them because it's similar to what you guys have in your institutions, and that's why we say sometimes that the antiques and the antique market actually fuels the wildlife trade, and that's why you also have to be regulated to make sure that we're protecting the African elephants and the Asian elephants and the sea turtles and the tortoises, all the wildlife that's out there that's unsustainable for the legal trade. That's about it.